is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we're enlightening you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah
compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: Israel launches airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip, and the tensions over a march by settlers in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. The UN warns of a worsening situation in the war-torn Ethiopian region of Tigray, where some 350,000 people are barely surviving in famine conditions. And Peru's socialist candidate Pedro Castillo claims victory in the presidential election, but his right-wing rival pledges to fight the result. Welcome to the program. Israeli drones and fighter jets have attacked the Palestinian training camp in the south of the Gaza Strip, as well as areas in Khan Yunis. A radio station belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas reported the attack. Explosions were also heard in Gaza City. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem says the bombing is a failed attempt to damage the solidarity between the resistance movements and Jerusalem Al-Quds. The latest aggression is the first Israeli strike on the enclave since a ceasefire ended 11 days of conflict last month. Earlier, we were joined by Ashraf Shannon, our man in Gaza, who gave us an update on the latest round of Israeli aggression against the enclave.
Drones initially attacked two security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, the Izzedine Qassam Brigades, one in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, and another one in the south of Gaza City. Minutes later, they used Israeli F-16 fighter jets to bomb those training centers that belong to Hamas's military wing. The Israeli military did issue a statement minutes ago saying that the attacks were in retaliation for incendiary balloons that were flown from the Gaza Strip earlier. Although Hamas is not responsible for the incendiary balloons, they were flown by Palestinian youth as a form of protest against the march by extremist Jewish settlers in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Hamas movement spokesperson Hazem Qasem said that the Israeli airstrikes were just another example of Israel's violation of Palestinian rights. And he also said that the Palestinian resistance factions will defend Jerusalem Al-Quds no matter what happens.
Israeli forces attacked Palestinians protesting against a march by Israeli settlers in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Palestinian Red Crescent said 33 people were injured during the clashes. Regime forces also arrested several Palestinians who were demonstrating against the so-called March of the Flags. Moreover, Israeli forces blocked Palestinians' access to the Damascus Gate leading to Old City and pushed them away from the area. Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements in the Gaza Strip had warned they would respond firmly to any provocative acts by the settlers. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh had sounded the alarm about dangerous repercussions of the Israeli event. Palestinian human rights lawyer Jonathan Kotov said the settlers' parade is so provocative that some Israelis advise against holding it this year.
Well, this is actually a recurring event that occurs several times, usually once a year. It celebrates the conquest of Jerusalem, and it's a very right-wing, racist celebration, insisting that Jerusalem is just for Jews, and it's usually done in a very provocative way, going through the Old City, through the Muslim quarters, through the areas where Palestinians usually live, basically to tell them, we won, we are the masters of this place, and you are worth nothing. In fact, it is so provocative that the Israeli police recommended that it be canceled this year, or that it take place in a different location and not in the Arab sectors and the Muslim sectors of the city. But unfortunately, they decided to do it there anyway.
A military exercise involving Italy, the U.S., the U.K., and Israel has wrapped up in southern Italy. The drills were aimed at enhancing combat readiness and strengthening bonds between allies and partners in view of potential conflict in West Asia. My correspondent Max Cibili is in Rome.
A military exercise on the Italian soil involving the United States, Israel, Italy, and the United Kingdom has caused much of a stir in Italy, with a number of lawmakers demanding the foreign and defense ministers to explain in parliament the extent of the operation. The 12-day exercise, dubbed Falcon Strike 21, led by the Italian Air Force, took place at the Amendola Air Base near Capitanata, a small village in the south of Italy. It involved multilateral training drills which aimed to boost the combat capability of Israeli F-35 fighter jet pilots.
My concern, and the concern of many citizens who witnessed the military drills, is over the high level of satisfaction expressed by representatives of the Israeli army. They overtly declared that the exercise was aimed at training Israeli fighter jet pilots for upcoming conflicts in the Middle East involving airstrikes on Iran. This is no conspiracy theory. The Times of Israel has published such remarks made by military officials.
Some Italian lawmakers have also argued that it is unacceptable that the same Israeli F-35 fighter jets which hit the Gaza Strip in mid-May were used in the military exercise. They say the Italian government's engagement in providing weapons or military training to Israel contravenes the country's constitutional principles and laws.
The Israeli Air Force repeatedly bombarded the Gaza Strip last month in its debut use of F-35 fighter jets made by U.S. Lockheed Martin. The regime's continued air and artillery bombardment claimed the lives of nearly 250 Palestinians, including 67 children, in the besieged enclave.
We don't want our country to provide arms or military know-how that could be used by Israel in a military attack, or that our country gets involved in a military conflict. It's against our constitution. It's unacceptable that the fighter jets used by Israel to bombard Palestine were on the Italian soil.
In May, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed deep shock at Israel's continued air and artillery bombardments of the Gaza Strip. Guterres said, "If there is a hell on earth, it is the lives of children in Gaza." Max Cibili, Rome.
Iran has hit back at Western nations for adopting what it calls a politicized approach toward its regional activities and missile program. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says the Islamic Republic is an anchor of peace and security in West Asia. Said Khatibzadeh says this is while the West has, quote, a serious record in this region. Khatibzadeh has advised NATO and G7 leaders to abide by international law instead of lecturing Iran. During a summit this week in Belgium, the Western Military Alliance urged Iran to stop all ballistic missile activities. NATO members further condemn Iran's influence in the region. Leaders of the world's seven industrialized nations took a similar stance at their meeting in southwest England over the weekend. The U.S. Agency for International Development says the Yemeni province of Ma'arib needs more donors, to provide additional humanitarian funding to address its growing crisis. Yemenis believe that the agency is using humanitarian assistance as a cover-up for its military activities, such as providing weapons for terrorist groups in Ma'arib, our correspondent in Sana'a reports.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Ma'arib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Ma'arib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Ma'arib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Ma'arib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is a proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al-Bayda and Ma'arib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda. Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Peace negotiations between the Taliban militants and the Afghan government have resumed in Qatar, the first time since talks stalled in April. Kabul said a meeting was held between the contact groups of the two neighboring, or I should say negotiating teams, and a comprehensive discussion was held on the organization and arrangement of the talks. A Taliban spokesman also tweeted a similar statement. Peace talks between the government and the Taliban hit an impasse when the group refused to participate in a summit in Turkey on Afghanistan's future. The resumption now comes as the U.S. is pulling out the last of its troops from Afghanistan by September. An Afghan delegation comprising politicians, MPs, and retired diplomats is in Islamabad under what is known as a track to diplomacy. This after negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban failed to show any sign of progress amid allegations that Islamabad is supporting the militant group. Javed Rana reports.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group, who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats think tanks and politicians from the both sides held meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s. And there is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish, their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Now, the UN has warned that famine in Ethiopia's war-torn Tigray region is getting worse. The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs said famine in Tigray could also spread to two other regions. Mark Lowcock said more than 2.3 million people are living in famine conditions or are only a step away. He was speaking at Security Council meeting. Ethiopia has disputed the figures and says aid groups have been granted access to those in need. The country has also said the situation in Tigray is a matter of domestic politics. The northern region has witnessed fighting between government forces and those loyal to regional leaders since November of last year. Thousands have been killed and many more displaced as a result. And Peruvian socialist candidate Pedro Castillo has claimed victory in the presidential runoff held on June the 6th. Castillo hailed his victory on Twitter, clinging to a narrow lead over his right-wing rival Keiko Fujimori. Vote counting has ended, but official results have not been announced yet. Fujimori has rejected her rival's claim of victory. She has made allegations of fraud with little proof. Fujimori has told supporters that she will keep fighting to defend Peru's democracy. The South American nation is currently struggling with an economic recession triggered by the coronavirus pandemic. And that's it with international news.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. future. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. As the time for this great event approaches, issues related to the election and activities of hostile media heat up to blacken the election process.
This indicates that elections have always been an attractive issue for the Western and Zionist media to stage psychological war and create anti-Iran atmosphere inside the country and abroad. As we have said several times, these media do their best to affect people's minds and make them disappointed about their role in elections. The events of 10th presidential elections in 2009 were the climax of such interventionist and seditionist activities. Ample evidence and documents show that some of the embassies in Tehran, particularly the British embassy, administered chaos and street rebellion in those days. Some of the elements of the British embassy, such as the second person in the mission, Thomas Byrne, were in contact with different figures in Iran. The insinuation of rigging in the election was the core of the British and American activities, which turned into the catchword of counter-revolutionary agents to kick up tumult in the country to pursue their vested interests. The Royal British Propaganda Horn, BBC Persian, and the VOA, in the weeks leading to the election, tried very much to affect public opinion and minimize participation at ballot boxes. This is why they turned a blind eye and deaf ear to the scandalous events of 2020 presidential election in the U.S. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on this, "Apart from who comes to power in the U.S., the current conditions are indicative of the intensive civil, political, and moral decadence in the U.S., and this is the issue which thinkers in America admit." Dear listeners, the occupation of the Congress by protesters and pro-Trump people for several hours was an unprecedented event in the history of the United States. This took place in order to oppose the wing of Joe Biden in the presidential election, but it was a very grave shame on even the self-styled democracy in the U.S. It was so shocking that even the Western pundits and figures of the Republican Party opposed it and took caustic stances against it. Fox News, while broadcasting the news of a big election scandal in the country, announced that the election crisis had just begun in the U.S. The news agency, quoting Trump's former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, spoke of exposure of an unprecedented rigging in favor of Biden. It said, "The Dominion system for changing the result of the election had been designed in Venezuela and then sold at the international market for manipulating the election. It was funded by the Venezuelan and Cuban money, and China had a role in it too. Therefore, if we want to speak of foreign meddling in the election, this event has now happened," unquote. In 2000, when the quarrel between Democratic candidate Al Gore and Republican candidate George W. Bush was settled, not by the people's vote, but by the vote of the Supreme Court, analysts of news agencies opined that it was an exceptional event in the bright history of American democracy, which will be like the hitting of a meteor if it would be repeated. Just 20 years later, insurgency stemming from election scandal turned many American cities such as New York, Denver, and Philadelphia into war fronts. These events laid bare the spurious and highly propagated image of democracy in the U.S. The Secretary General of the Lebanese legendary anti-terrorist movement, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said, "What took place in the American election is the scandal of democracy. And the issue is not related just to Trump, but the Republican Party. This comes while many Arab regimes accuse Iran of being an undemocratic country, while most of them, including the Saudi regime, have not experienced elections so far. Expert of international issues Sayed Mohammad Marandi said, "With the scandal that occurred in the U.S., the country is in no position to preach on Iran's elections." Marandi described people's massive turnout in the election as the sign of the failure of the so-called maximum pressure policy, saying, "Naturally, the more fervent the election is held in Iran, and the more actively people participate in it, it will be considered a negative point for the U.S., and they will consider this issue in their calculations about Iran."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
Hamas leaders have reportedly warned Egyptian mediators that they would take an important decision regarding the mutual ceasefire in the event Israel continues such unnecessary aggravations by the end of this week. The Palestinian warning came in the wake of the Qataris informing the United Nations and officials in the Biden administration that such a step provokes the Palestinians and pushes towards an explosive situation. The Palestinian message precedes the Egyptians sending invitations to 19 resistance factions to attend high-level meetings in Cairo in the presence of President Mahmoud Abbas to open dialogue between the Palestinian Authority and the resistance factions in Gaza. For the first time, Cairo invites many resistance factions other than Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to attend the dialogues at the request of Hamas, given that all the factions were equal partners in the last battle, despite objections from certain members of the Fatah movement. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions stressed in a joint statement the need to stop all provocations practiced by the occupation in occupied Al-Quds and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, to stop the aggression against the Palestinian people, to speed up reconstruction, and to lift the siege on Gaza. In the meantime, commander of the southern region in the Israeli occupation forces, Eliezer Toledano, announced that the army was preparing to resume fighting with Hamas again, because apparently what Israel did in the last round of terrorism against Gaza was not enough, adding that the next operation will not end without changing the security reality in Gaza. Adding salt to the injury, right-wing Zionist Jewish groups announced last week that they would redo the flag march they usually did on what they call Jerusalem Day next Thursday, after their provocative march this year was canceled due to heightened tensions. The march is expected to begin at 7 p.m. Al-Quds time on Thursday, June 10, and head through multiple routes towards the Western Wall near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli occupation forces have reportedly approved the march. However, Palestinian natives have warned that this provocation will only lead to renewed clashes. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Palestinian factions prepare for dialogue in Cairo, the invasive scene in Gaza is becoming more complex, foretelling the possibility of another confrontation again in light of Israel's insistence on pushing the Gaza Strip. While all border crossings have been closed since the last aggression, Israel's obstruction of the Qatari fund into Gaza poured fuel on the fire calling for a strongly worded message from the resistance, in which it affirmed that unless the funds are released by this week, it will be concerned with taking an important decision regarding the cessation of hostilities. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Julia. Now, the resistance factions have informed the Egyptian and the international mediators that the continuous Israeli provocations toward Gaza and its besieged citizens who are to benefit from the Qatari fund or the grant, which Israel is blocking, which more than 100,000 Palestinian families will be benefiting from, it will directly mean a push towards an escalation of the situation in Gaza. Do you think that Gaza can handle another round of the Israeli terrorism and violence?
Better question is, can the Zionist entity handle another round of Gazan resistance? And the answer is, it knows that it can't. The ceasefire that was called for was a one-sided ceasefire, with the Zionist entity basically begging for it, especially after basically receiving news that not only was the Zionist entity brought to its knees when the Gazan resistance barely even exhausted their old stockpiles, but the whole resistance axis was prepared to also come in on the condition that Gaza would, of course, invite them. But Israel was just definitely not ready to face like another round of rockets, including 300 rockets total fired at once, 150 alone at Tel Aviv. So it was terrified then. It's still terrified now. It's trying to even put pressure to make sure that the resistance doesn't respond to its provocations. And its provocations that we've seen in the last few weeks, including the attacks on Al-Aqsa, the harassment of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. It's trying to kind of push the envelope as far as to make itself look scary, but immediately stops once it realizes that the repercussions in another round of fighting could lead to its demise, most certainly. They released Muhammad and Muna al-Kurd within hours of detaining them, and this is out of fear. 2 days ago, the Zionist entity canceled the military parade, and today they were too afraid to even wave their occupier flags in Jerusalem. So I would say that it is actually Israel that is put on the defensive this time.
Well, Julia, the resistance did vow that if the provocations do not stop by the end of this week, it will take an important decision by stopping or just throwing away any kind of cessation of a fire or ceasefire. Mind you now, last week Isaac Herzog was elected as the new president of the Zionist entity, and it seems that a new government is on the verge of being formed in the Israeli entity. But is it wise for Netanyahu at this moment to get involved in another round of aggression, which he sees the best, maybe the best boat out of this chaos inside of the Israeli regime?
Yeah, so Netanyahu's regime, Netanyahu and his party specifically, the far-right coalition he attempted to assemble up and push the deal of the century, which failed, the provocations against Lebanon, the attacks on resistance factions in Syria and on the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq 2 years ago, those have backfired. So Netanyahu right now in an attempt to shore up legitimacy, especially in the face of a multi-factional coalition of the Zionist entity that's attempting to kind of save face of the entity itself in light of Netanyahu's repeated failures. He's just trying to kind of salvage the little legitimacy that he is attempting to have. He has corruption charges, the collapse of his government and his coalition. So what this is essentially is that, like I said, he knows that he can't really stand a chance militarily or even politically at this point. But it's an attempt to save face, essentially.
Well, during all these developments, we did see an invitation by Cairo for 19 Palestinian factions from the Gaza Strip that took part in the last battle against Gaza. This meeting is supposed to happen in Cairo in the presence of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And as I told you, most of the factions are invited for the first time in such high-level talks. But some Fatah movement members were vocal about their rejection of such an invitation, meaning a wide scope invitation allowing all the Palestinian factions in. But is there a chance that these talks might actually be fruitful, given that Abbas still refuses to acknowledge the last, the very last election that happened when Hamas won the election?
The whole context of the talks reflects the context of the Palestinian resistance and the force on the ground, essentially. So the Palestinian resistance is more united than ever. They have been more united in the face of struggle and in the face of the siege that has last occurred. And it is also clearer than ever that the PA, which is essentially the neo-colonial force, you know, containing Gaza, I mean, containing the West Bank at the direction of the occupation, which has collaborated against Palestinian, the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to the benefit of the Zionist occupation, their legitimacy has completely collapsed. And they, just as Israel is more insecure than ever, so is the Palestinian Authority. As a neo-colonial police force that is essentially losing its legitimacy and authority. So see, in the face of a Palestinian resistance that is essentially more unified than ever, it's just clear that the these recent remarks and this bitterness by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority reaffirms its lack of stance at all with the Palestinian resistance and with the Palestinian people. And this is something that's consistent.
Well, in the meantime, we had the commander of the southern region of Israeli occupation forces, his name is Eleazar Toledano, announced that Israel is preparing to resume the fighting against Gaza, and they have in mind that this time they will not allow the security of the resistance to remain intact inside of the Gaza Strip. So we're talking about massacres here, a continuation of the incremental genocide by the Israeli entity against the people of Gaza. Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear. The Secretary General of Hezbollah said in his last appearance that there will be a regional war if the Zionist entity provokes the Palestinian people, whether it is in Gaza or in Al-Quds. But he was very clear, Al-Quds equals a regional war. Do you think that we are on the verge of the biggest war that this region has ever seen?
You know, I think that I'm positive that the Zionist entity's talks right now, you know, it wanting to be provocative, it's just empty talk, essentially, because it understands, and the resistance has made it clear, Yahya Sinwar of Hamas and Sayyid Nasrallah have made it very, very clear, along with other, you know, leaders of the resistance axis, that there is full support and coordination from all members of the resistance axis to the resistance factions in Gaza, and this will be furthered into a complete campaign to liberate Palestine and Al-Aqsa should Israel fall completely through on its provocations and wage another attack of the same nature. We're to see that becoming more clear by the end of this week. But it is definitely clear that the Zionist entity, though they do not want to have any kind of provocations that's going to make them instantly lose, they still kind of want to save face. I mean, the entity begged for a ceasefire just because people, settlers, were tired of running to bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's just a balance that the Zionist entity is trying to have of saving face and trying to make itself look like it has any legitimacy left, which it doesn't, can ensure any protection of its illegal settlers, which it can't. And the resistance, which is on the verge of victory right now, we can envision victory as Lebanese, as Palestinians. And there is full preparation to achieve it and attain it if this Zionist entity makes any stupid moves.
Well, it's going to be a very decisive week indeed. Thank you very much, Julia Qasim from Beirut, political commentator, talking to us about the prospects of another ignition of fire between the Palestinians and the Israeli Zionist entity. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen being part of the equation of Al-Quds.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, leader of the Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that the Yemeni people are part of the deterrent situation established by regional resistance in linking the Israeli threat towards al-Quds to a regional war. Sayyid Houthi criticized the Saudi and the Emirati media and their shameful handling of the recent Israeli aggression on Gaza while praising the Iranian position. Sayyid Houthi also identified three steps to attain peace in Yemen: stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the siege, and ending the occupation. More in this following report.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, stressed last week that the Yemenis are part of the Al-Quds formula, as announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, and will be present effectively in the battle against the Zionist entity. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah consecrated, during his speech on the 21st anniversary of Resistance and Liberation Day, a new formula: if Israel tampers with al-Quds, it will face a regional war. Sayyid Houthi indicated that Hezbollah and the Palestinian resistance were not supported by any Arab or Muslim state except Iran and Syria, highlighting the importance of the recent victory in Gaza. Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement then urged Muslim countries to join forces against Israel in order to expel its regime from the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds and to completely boycott the Tel Aviv regime. The Yemeni leader noted that the pro-Israeli traitors accused the resistance forces of being Iran's proxy groups, adding that the Tikfiri war launched against them only serves the U.S. and Israel. Meanwhile, Sayyid Houthi stressed that the peaceful solution in Yemen can be reached when the Saudi-led coalition halts its war and blockade on the Yemenis, adding that the Yemeni nation will not give up its right to freedom, independence, and dignity, and will not abandon its struggle against American and Israeli plots. Furthermore, in an indication of positive developments in the ongoing negotiations to stop the Saudi war in Yemen, an Omani delegation arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a on a visit, the first of its kind in years, on Saturday. The delegation was accompanied to Sana'a Airport by the spokesman of the Ansarullah Resistance Movement and the head of the Sana'a negotiating delegation, Muhammad Abdus Salam, on a plane belonging to the Omani Royal Air Force. Upon his arrival at Sana'a Airport, Abdus Salam said that the delegation of the Royal Office came to discuss the situation in Yemen on the basis of the principle of common interests. Abdus Salam noted that the aim of the Omani delegation's visit was to work on advancing the humanitarian situation as well as the peace process.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Muhammad Ashami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Muhammad. Now, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi made it clear that Yemen will be part of the deterrence equation established by Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah in linking the Israeli threat towards al-Quds to a regional war. Are we going to see Yemeni ballistic missiles landing in the occupied territories of Palestine against the Zionist entity?
Israeli occupation forces take those warnings lightly from both Sayyid Nasrullah and Sayyid al-Houthi, and I believe we may see defense operations and ballistic missiles, drone attacks as well, following the Zionist forces from Yemen. The remarks by both leaders reflect a higher improved level of coordination amongst the resistance access, and affirms that Yemen today is a strong integral part of this new equation.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, Sayyid Abdul Malik went on to say that the Saudi and the Emirati media outlets took up a hostile position towards the Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian resistance factions inside of Gaza, who were we were bombing retaliatory rocket attacks against the Israeli entity, proving their allegiance to the Zionist regime. Sadly, I'm talking about the media in the Persian Arab Gulf states. This strategy was surely part of the normalization process which these states have started with the Zionist entity last year. Do you think this strategy was enough maybe to subdue their citizens into accepting ties with this warmongering entity that committed massacres against the Palestinian people?
We all noticed that both Saudi and the Emirati exerted a very high level of media effort trying to spread their propaganda against Iran and the Palestinian resistance, while covering up also at the same time for the war crimes committed by the Israeli occupation. This in itself can be taken as an indication that there are many people inside Saudi and the UAE who do not probably buy into this narration, Zionist Arab version of the narration, especially following the resistance latest victory in Gaza, and the increasing awareness that Iran has been actually at the heart of Palestine, supporting and assisting its resistance. So no, I don't think that people are buying that narration.
Well, something very important happened on Saturday is the landing of Omani plane, on board of which is Omani committee alongside the spokesperson of the Ansarullah movement, which breaks way for serious negotiations and dialogue to end the Saudi war on Yemen. What are your views on this?
The Omani delegation that has just arrived with the head of the national delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, they arrived a couple of days back, and they said that they are continuing the discussions they had started in Muscat. Mohammed Abdel Salam did not comment much about it, but he implied in his brief comments that they will be discussing first the humanitarian issues, and hopefully if the coalition is serious about it this time, then this may lead to opening other discussions leading to complete ceasefire and bringing back peace to Yemen. We hope that they are serious about it this time.
Sayyid Abdelmalik al-Houthi did identify three very important steps for peace in Yemen, which includes stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the blockade and the siege of the Yemeni population, and ending the occupation. He means the Saudi and the Emirati occupation of Yemeni land. Mohammed bin Salman has turned several opportunities down that would have made this halting of an aggression at least somewhat easier than bringing it to this level right now. What is Mohammed bin Salman really counting on that would secure him a political gain, which for the past 6 years he had never been able to attain on the field, in the battlefield of Yemen?
Well, let's agree on one thing first. Saudi has lost its military war in Yemen. On the other hand, Yemen counterattacks are becoming more severe, more frequent, and more painful. So what are the options for Saudi? Causing maximum humanitarian damage to 30 million people. And that's what they are trying to do. They use that to negotiate military terms. For example, they say, okay, we will release you some of the fuel vessels provided you stop advancing towards Marib, which is ridiculous. Sayyid Abdelmalik met the UN representative, Mr. Martin Griffith, last Sunday, and he warned him against continuing to exploit the humanitarian issues of the people. And he affirmed that this will not get them any gains, political gains. And he said that if they continue this, it only means that they are not serious about bringing back peace to Yemen or ending their war.
Well, in the meantime, the Yemeni armed forces are making great advances in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, while also simultaneously achieving groundbreaking reconciliation with many Yemeni tribes in that governorate, which means that less fighting is ahead. It means more reconciliation is to be viewed in the future. How significant do you think the liberation of Ma'rib will be in changing the balance of power in this ongoing Saudi onslaught of Yemen?
Very important. The liberation of Marib can significantly alter the whole political terrain, and most probably will determine the subsequent outcomes for years to come. The governorate is oil rich, and it has been used as stronghold by the coalition for their military operations for the past 6-7 years. Losing it means losing a major source of finance. It also means that the forces that are there will be outcasted. There are several mix of mercenary groups that are fighting alongside the coalition, including Al-Qaeda. And if they are outcasted from Marib, they will not have an alternative place to be in. If they go towards the south, they are not welcomed. And that will further complicate the problems that the coalition is already facing with its different factions there.
But would you think that a liberation of Ma'rib would actually complicate the dialogue of the peace process in Yemen?
No, actually it will foster it, I think, because they are trying to protect Ma'rib with every level of strength that they have. I think it will be a very good game because they will not have any more strong points to negotiate on.
Well, the very important issue in this negotiation that is to be taking place, if it is already taking place, is the humanitarian status inside of Yemen. As you mentioned before, there are more than 13 million civilians in Yemen on the verge of complete starvation. What do you think will be the biggest challenge for Ansarullah in the event of a ceasefire?
In the event of a ceasefire, there will be a challenge of inclusion. Let's say the goal would be to include all the political parties and start resume, let's say, to resume the peace process again.
Mm-hmm.
It is that peace process, if you remember, before, just before this military intervention by Saudi, that was going under UN supervision. And almost the previous, the ex-UN representative, Jamal bin Omar, said Yemenis were about to reach a historical consensus, a peaceful agreement, when this military action started on March 2015. So if they stop their aggression, I think it would be less of a challenge to resume that peace process and include everybody, but in terms of level terms, not with domination coming from Saudi or the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator, who joined us from Sana'a to talk about the prospects of talks, negotiations, and complete cessation of a war against Yemen, and also the inclusion of Yemen in the Al-Quds versus a regional war equation set up by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Shami, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
After an 11-day bombing campaign in Gaza that killed hundreds of Palestinians, including 67 children, the Israeli regime has its hand out to its greatest ally for an additional $1 billion in emergency military aid, on top of the $3.8 billion Washington provides each year, says Dave DeCamp, author in an article titled, After Gaza Slaughter, Israeli Regime Wants Another $1 Billion Out of U.S. Stay tuned for the details. After an 11-day bombing campaign in Gaza that killed hundreds of Palestinians, including 67 children, the Zionist regime has its hand out to its greatest ally for an additional $1 billion in emergency military aid, on top of the $3.8 billion Washington provides each year. The Iron Dome is one of the Zionist regime's U.S.-funded missile defense systems. President Biden has recently promised that he would replenish the Iron Dome, a sign that getting the $1 billion out of Washington will not be very hard for the Israelis. Throughout the 11-day slaughter, the U.S. refused to condemn the Israeli regime killing of Palestinian children and gave the Israelis political cover by blocking U.N. Security Council statements calling for a ceasefire. In a pathetic attempt to pretend that the Biden administration cares about the suffering Zionist regime is causing, Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced additional aid for the Palestinians after the truce was reached. The assistance includes about $5.5 million to rebuild Gaza, a pittance compared to what the U.S. is poised to give the Zionist regime. In an interview with the Zionist regime's Channel 12, Blinken somehow claimed that Israel took significant steps to avoid killing civilians in Gaza. This ignores the deliberate targeting of civilian homes. In one Israeli regime air raid, bombs hit a residential building in Al-Shari refugee camp in Gaza, killing 10 people, 2 women and 8 children. Besides killing over 250 Palestinians, the bombing campaign wounded 2,000, about 600 of which were children, and destroyed critical civilian infrastructure. The violence was not limited to Gaza. In the West Bank and East Al-Quds, at least 29 Palestinians were gunned down by the Zionist regime security forces. As usual, throughout the slaughter, U.S. officials made sure to repeatedly say that they support Israelis' right to defend itself. The Zionist regime's bombing campaign started after rockets were fired out of Gaza in response to violence against Palestinians in East Al-Quds. Particularly, the Zionist regime